Kevin Danaher is a co-founder of Global Exchange and is now Global Exchange's Director of Public Education. He has written or edited many books examining U.S. foreign policy and the global economy. His most recent volume, Democratizing the Global Economy, The Battle Against the World Bank and the IMF, was published in fall 2000. Other recent volumes include Globalize This, The Battle Against the World Trade Organization, and Corporations Are Gonna Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream. Dr. Danaher received his doctorate in sociology from the University of California at Santa Cruz in 1982. Before joining Global Exchange, he was a senior analyst at Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and for 4 years he taught in the School of Government at American University. Please welcome Kevin Danaher now. Thanks.
Let me say, I think what's going on right here, I know a lot of us have been depressed. I was terrorized. I grew up in New York. I had friends very directly affected in their families by September 11th. You know, it's hard. It's like when you lose somebody in a family, you got to go through that grieving process. Notice there were a lot of people in positions of power who immediately jumped to an opportunistic place and started to push their pre-existing agenda before the bodies were recovered from the rubble. Our leaders could have said, we'll get these guys who did this, but right now we're going to grieve. And until we recover all the bodies from the rubble, we're not going to do anything precipitous and kill other innocent victims in other parts of the world. They could have said that. They didn't. So I think you have to step back and clear your consciousness from the violence and the terror and the stupidity and all this God is on our side stuff. And realize that what's happening is there's a cleaving going on right here. We are at the end of a cycle. We are in the middle of a paradigm shift. The old paradigm that is in its death paroxysms, the Sotho people in South Africa say a dying bull kicks the hardest. Ooh, you know, watch out, don't get in the way of that leg. You know, it'll kick you. So the paradigm that is dying is love of money, money values, violence, and God is on my side. The new paradigm, yeah, notice that paradigm fits both Bush and bin Laden. It's the same meme, right? The alternative paradigm that's coming up from the grassroots around the world, which I'm going to spend most of my time talking about, and I think David and I are both, it's interesting, our careers, we're both old fogies, and we've done all this critique the system stuff, and now we're getting more into this, well, instead of yelling at people, your boat's on fire, let's build that alternative boat so people have something to jump into. Because, you know, people know the system sucks, okay? That's why working class people say, thank God it's Friday, not thank God it's Monday, you know? People know it. They know it at some level. So the old paradigm is love of money, violence, God is on my side. The new paradigm is love of life, the life cycle, human rights and the environment, nonviolence, and God doesn't take sides, especially in intra-species conflicts. Give me a break. You know, think about, you know, if you could tune in to the antenna wavelength of black ants and red ants engaged in a fight, and the black ants are saying, God is on our side. Red ants are saying, God is on our side. You'd go, oh, you stupid ants. Mm-hmm. So if the ants could tune in to CNN, you know, and whatever Al-Qaeda's network is, or, you know, however they. So you got love of money versus love of life, violence versus nonviolence, God is on our side versus God doesn't take sides, particularly in intra-species conflicts. Our agenda is to replace minority rule with full democracy, right? People don't realize we have minority rule. They got minority rule in Saudi Arabia. They got minority rule in Afghanistan. We have minority rule here. Right, half the population didn't vote in the last election, and the guy who got the lesser amount of votes became president thanks to his brother's state and a five-person conservative majority in the Supreme Court. If that happened in Nigeria or Bolivia, everybody'd be saying, oh, corruption, man, oh, it's corrupt. It was his brother's province. Mm-hmm. So we have to replace We have to replace corporate minority rule with full democracy. From the roots of the word democracy, demos, people, kratos, rule, people rule. This is a republic. Republic comes from two Latin roots, res, meaning thing, and publica, meaning of the people. It is a thing of the people. A democratic republic is a thing of the people that is rule by the people. We were taught in school there's three branches of government. There's not. There's four: judicial, legislative, executive. And the fourth, which is the most powerful, which is supposed to rule over the other three, is we, the people, the citizens. We are supposed to be self-governing citizens. So when you're getting into arguments with your conservative brothers and sisters, remind them that in the rotunda in Washington of the Jefferson Memorial, anytime you're in D.C., go there late at night, 2 or 3 in the morning, it's open 24 hours a day, lights are on, it's free, and you got all these great quotes of Jefferson chiseled in the marble. The highest one, up in the top of the rotunda, you got to get dizzy, turning around, reading it, says, "I pledge on the altar of God undying hostility to any government restriction on the free minds of the people." Any restriction on the free minds of the people. That's all you need. That, you know, just that. Because we got the most diverse population in the country. One of the questions you'll see on that sheet is, seeing as we have the most diverse population in the country, how come we're just seeing these testosterone-poisoned white male guys from the military-industrial complex on TV going, "War dance, war dance, war dance"? You know? How about if we frame it, instead of war, as crime against humanity, and instead of going to that nationalist place, let's wrap ourselves in the flag and go to war against the rest of the world and kill innocent civilians, collateral damage, say criminal justice framing, reach out to all the other victims of terrorism. You know, Algeria's been destroyed by terrorism. Did they get to declare war on the rest of the world? No. Egypt, Germany, France, there's plenty of countries had terrorism, right? And there's the whole question of, you know, state terrorism. You know, terrorists are the ones without the F-16s. They got to steal planes to do it, you know? Like black kids in South Africa, when they got criticized in the white media about necklacing, or Kentucky, they called it Kentucky, put a gasoline-soaked tire around somebody and light it on fire. He said, "Ooh, that's barbaric." They said, "Well, we'd prefer to kill people like white people do with guns, but we don't have guns. So we use what we have." Now, that's not to condone violence. I don't want anybody walking out of here tonight saying, "Danaher justified the violence of September 11th. It is really sickening to me that if you try to explain why something happened, people will say, "Oh, you're justifying." There's a difference between a reason and an excuse, okay? Let's get that clear. Let's raise the intellectual level of debate in this country above kindergarten level. My 11-year-old daughter knows the difference, okay? Some guy calls up. I do a lot of AM radio, a lot of these right-wing talk shows. So I'm on this talk show in Detroit, and this guy calls and he says, "Yeah, well, if Osama bin Laden was coming down the street killing people, what would you do?" I said, "I'd shoot him with my shotgun." Silence on the other end. The guy, you know, it's like, dude, what do you want? You want me to get down and bark at the dog? Is that what you want? You know, the dog comes out barking at you? You get down and bark at the dog? No. You rise to a higher level of consciousness, right? So there's a whole bunch of political movements around the world that are raising the same question. When policy decisions get made, particularly around how capital gets invested, two questions. Who's sitting at the table? Is it a monocrop? Or is it biodiverse? Monocrop. You know how monocrop works? You have to kill all other forms of life that try to express themselves. A political policy-making monocrop has to silence all the other voices in society that aren't white male millionaires. I had nothing against white male millionaires. That's not what I'm saying. I'd let my daughter marry a white male millionaire, okay? It's about, if you only have one small sector of society making policy, and there are people who never ride the bus, you think you're going to get good mass transit policy? Duh. You got people making housing policy who live in mansions and gated communities. You got people making energy policy who don't pump their own gas. It's called the feedback loop, sociology 101. If you don't have different voices, if we said, let's have lesbian carpenters run the country, everybody say, "Wait a minute, Kevin, they're a small percentage of the population. White male millionaire corporate lawyers are some big percentage of the population?" I don't think so. Last time I checked the demographics, it wasn't that way. So here's the context. And if people want to talk about this September 11th thing in the discussion, that's fine. I want to try and shift this into a larger framework. Think about this. Go back. Biggest framework, 3 million years, right? We all come from Africa. Lucy is our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, right? We all come from Africa. Some of us left there a long time ago. Some of us left more recently, right? But we all come from Africa. What's the most suffering part of the planet right now? What does that mean to the spirituality of this species that the most suffering part of the planet is our ancestral homeland where we all trace our roots? Well, I don't. I love my mother. Yeah. Some people in power. Yeah, we got to unpack the we. That's the thing, is that pronoun. Or our children. All the children in the world are our children. So that's your big context, right? Is human beings have the ability to do us and them. They. Right? They. And we project our negative attributes, which we all possess, surprise, out onto them. And if we could just kill them, everything would be fine. Duh. No, it's transference. It's a very simple psychological process, right? So the goal, in terms of big species goal, is to get to a place where we behave on a day-to-day basis in our institutions, et cetera, as if we're all us. They are you and I dressed differently. They are you and I speaking a different language. It's why at Global Exchange we do reality tours, like Reverse Club Med, take people out to third world countries, get them off the beach, meet real people. Come down to a several thousand year context. You have three religions that are all children of Abraham: Judaism, Islam, Christianity. They're monotheistic, paternalistic religions. God is a he, which, think about this for like 2 seconds. If God is going to be a gender, it ain't going to be a he, it's going to be a she. You know? Think about this, right? Where do babies come from? Yoo-hoo, guys, right? So you dig why in all species, the male is more attractive, not pretty, but able to attract attention. You know, the big mane of the lion, the female lion's playing. A peacock, all those beautiful. You ever see a peahen? Plain brown bird. Why is that? That's so that when the predator comes, it will eat the male. That's why it is. Check it out. History of biology. Oh, so now we get the perspective. So, you know, one guy's there. I'm an architect. I build buildings. I'm a soldier. I destroy buildings. Hey, you know what, rooster? You don't lay eggs, dude. You do not lay eggs, okay? So you can do all that crowing and fighting and dancing around. And all. You don't lay eggs, okay? You don't lay eggs. And you don't taste as good either. Sorry for your non-meat eaters. But, you know, think, which is the more essential gender is a female. If God's going to be a gender, which I don't think God is, but if God was, it'd be a female. Guys are needed for like 5 seconds, right? Maybe less in some cases. And one male could repopulate the whole species. You just get a little bit less genetic diversity, that's all. You know? So we got a big challenge here, gentlemen. And I use the term very loosely, right? We have to clean up our act, right, and participate in the changing of power in terms of the gender imbalance in the institutions. And partly I say that because, you know, my wife is Medea Benjamin, so I'm well trained. I've had 17 years of, you know, yes, honey, I'll do the dishes. Is the laundry folded correctly? Real macho man. You know what real macho is in a man? Real macho is the guy who, when the baby cries in the middle of the night, says, honey, don't get up. I'll take care of the baby. Yeah. That's real macho. It's not about bar fights. Bar fight. I've been in bar fights. I've seen bar fights. You know who the tough guys are in bar fights? The guys who just stand there right in the middle of it. Just stand there looking at it. Above it. You know, going, this is idiocy. I saw a guy one time in a bar fight. Guy was threatening him. He said, go ahead, hit me your best shot. You know, Jesus, turn the other cheek. But he wasn't saying it like, turn the other cheek and let him just, you know, masochistically. It was like a kind of Pacino, Robert De Niro. Hey, that was a good shot. Hit me over here now. Hey, that was good. Hit me over here now. Hey, that was good. Hit me over. What? How long is it going to take you to get this violence out of your mind that you do not eliminate your opposition? If we're having a debate, let's say David and I are opposite sides of the political spectrum, which we're not, luckily. I wouldn't want to be on the opposite side of him. But let's say we're having a debate. And in the middle of it, I punch him and knock him out. Did I win the debate or lose the debate? I lost the debate. Everybody's going to go, Danaher, you're a moron. Right? So let's be clear about this violence silencing the opposition kind of stuff, right? It's just stupid. So think, you've got these three paternalistic monotheisms coming out of the same tribal roots, and there is a small 5 or 10% fundamentalist right wing of each, tiny minority. And I don't like the word fundamental, you know, fun and mental. It's fun to be mental. I think we got to take that word away from them. Like conservative, conserve, or the flag. Let's take the flag back. I don't want the right wing to have the flag. I want us to have the flag. You know, people, I've been in Cuba and places. They go, you Americans, you're ashamed of your flag? What's that about? We're working on it. So that's your several thousand year context. You got the far right violent element of three paternalistic monotheisms fighting each other, and they want to put us in the middle. Hey, I say take Sharon, Bush, and Bin Laden, put them out naked on one of those irradiated islands in the Pacific, and let them duke it out. Don't put me in the middle. I don't want my family in the middle of that garbage. You know, I didn't vote for those clowns. We've got three major crises on the planet. This is our context and our challenge to see what we can do in the next few decades to solve this. First is the crisis of social inequality. We've got 20% of the world's people consuming about 86% of the world's resources, 80%, the poorest 80% of the world's people consuming about 14% of the world's resources, results in children dying at a rate of about one every few seconds from hunger. There are more children in Africa dying each year from AIDS than died in the entire Holocaust. Each year, children in Africa dying from AIDS greater than the children who died during the Holocaust. What do we say about the people who didn't struggle to eliminate the Nazi death camps? Oh, morally bankrupt. Oh, those bad Germans, they didn't stand up. Hey, what if the current German military named its attack helicopters the Jew and the Gypsy and the Homo? What are our attack helicopters called? The Apache, the Blackhawk. These are people that were genocided. And we name, you know, U.S. troops, when they invaded Iraq, were referring to it as Indian territory. And Native Americans who were in the military were going, whoa, dude, do you have to do that? You know, do you have to rub salt into the wounds? There's some real serious lack of self-criticism in this society. Second crisis, in addition to the crisis of social inequality, is the environmental crisis. Water pollution, topsoil loss, air quality standards, people getting sick in Mexico City on a regular basis from breathing human feces, right? Because in the poor neighborhoods without sewage and flush toilets, you take the night soil buckets out, dump them in the garbage dump, dries out, desiccates into the air as powder. Air inversion layer comes in. Is there any other species that breathes its own shit? I don't think so. I think we're unique. We're number one. Ocean levels are rising. How about this? You want to really get the bejesus scared out of you? Look at the data on early signs of slippage and melting in the West Antarctic ice sheet. Not the ice shelf. The ice shelf is in the water. The ice sheet is up on rock. The West Antarctic ice sheet, which is starting to show some early signs of movement, is the size of Brazil. In places, it is 7,000 feet thick. If it slides off its rock into the ocean, you will get a 12 to 20 foot rise in ocean levels. Bye-bye, Santa Cruz. Bye-bye, Santa. Bye-bye, Key West. If you own any real estate in Key West, I would suggest you go for higher altitude. In fact, probably most of the state of Florida is going to go bye-bye. So think about it. Don't, you know, come on. I have relatives down there. I resemble that remark. So you got the environmental crisis. You guys know about that. I don't want to get apocalyptic and really, you know, because, you know, fear is not a good motivator. Fear is a paralytic. Just like guilt is a paralytic. Oh, I'm so guilty. I was born into a rich family. Hey, if you were born into a rich family, I want to talk to you about our major donor program at Global Exchange, okay? So relax on that guilt stuff. The third crisis, which is produced by the other two, is a spiritual moral crisis. Dante said the hottest parts of hell are reserved for those who in times of moral crisis maintain their neutrality. We used to say in the 60s, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. So we did have a few things right in the 60s. Where's the monument to those of us who were against the Vietnam War? That's what I want to know. Where's that monument? We were right. You know, we were right about that war. And you know, it's like, oh, let's glorify the killers. You know, the killing, 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 killing. Enough killing already. If that stuff worked, we'd have peace in the world right now. Israel would be the safest country in the world if that stuff worked. It doesn't work, okay? It breeds the same thing. So the moral crisis finds many manifestations. I don't see any crisis. The Rush Limbaugh, global warming, it's a myth, all that. Or overpopulation, I like that. Let's blame the poor, blame the victims. Duh, it's not about numbers of people. It's about how much of the world's resources does each person consume, okay? We're the population crisis. If you correct for resource consumption, I don't have two daughters. I have 50 kids. In terms of resource consumption, that's what I got. I got 50 kids. So it's me that's the problem, not the woman in Kenya who's having her 14th kid because the husband sees it as a status symbol. Maybe one of the kids will score a job in the government and bail them all out. You know, you're playing the percentages. Some of your kids might make it. The more you have, the women don't have access to birth control. The women are disempowered vis-a-vis the men, et cetera, et cetera. I always say to these right-wingers when they say overpopulation, hey, you want to deal with population? Then support women's liberation. That's how you're going to, that, you know, if you look at it, right, you get literacy, birth rates go down. So I always remind people, I talk to Christians and do a lot of Christian radio, and I remind them that Jesus was totally nonviolent. The guy was into unconditional love, right? Unconditional love, meaning love everybody, love your enemy. But he did use violence once. And what occupation did he pick? He didn't pick Roman soldiers. He didn't pick tax collectors, bankers. It was bankers. And he whipped them. And it was right after that, according to the four basic testaments, the four basic disciples, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that he was killed right after that. That was where he went overboard, right? Well, who runs the world right now? It's bankers. It's money values, the money cycle. So if you're really a Christian, get out your whip. See, I say to people, you know, in this movement protesting the World Bank and IMF, we're like 99.9% less violent than Jesus. We don't want to whip James Wolfensohn, the head of the World Bank. We just want to change his institution and change the rules. We don't whip the guy. It's not about you, James. We're going to change your institution. So that's the top-down elite globalization about money values. The bottom-up globalization has three big pieces that we work in at Global Exchange. One is to expose secret global government. That's the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO. It's secret global government based on money values. Corporations are the only ones at the table, et cetera. Second piece is the corporate accountability movement, going at the corporations directly, trying to change their behavior, take away their corporate charters, you know, that kind of stuff, direct, transform the bottom line from being solely financial to being a triple bottom line, social accountability, environmental sustainability, and yeah, you gotta make a profit or you go out of business, but do you exploit people in nature to make that profit? And then what do you do with the profit? Have 10 BMWs and a cocaine habit or put it back into social justice work, right? It's two different approaches. The third, which I want to focus on tonight, is the alternative economic institutions. So I'm just going to run through some of these quickly. Socially responsible investing has taken off like a rocket in the past two decades. A lot of it came out of the anti-apartheid movement, redefining the bottom line. There's now trillions of dollars. If you get the Co-op America National Green Pages, it's a nice little directory, about 190 pages, of all these alternative economic institutions. The finance section of alternative financial organizations, shareholder activism, socially responsible investing, environmentally screened investing, is hundreds and hundreds of groups. They have their own federations now. They are controlling trillions, not billions, but trillions of dollars in wealth, right? Then if you add into that the pension funds of trade unions, that's more trillions. And it's probably like $2 or $3 trillion, something like that, right? And going up all the time. If we get control of that money and direct it, that's a huge amount of change. You got alternative models of ownership going on, new forms of property ownership. 6.5% of the U.S. economy is nonprofits. There's 47,000 cooperatives in the United States. 2,500 worker-owned businesses. Part of this is about redefining free enterprise. That's why I love talking with the right-wingers and the establishment guys. Free enterprise. I say, okay, wait. Does free enterprise mean the freedom of big corporations to go anywhere, do anything they want to workers and the environment? Or does it mean the freedom of everyone to be enterprising? Which is it? The latter takes you in a democratic direction. Protect family farms, protect the mom and pop sector, defend the independent bookstores against Amazon.com, which is going to go bust. Don't worry, they're crashing. Smoke coming out of the tail. Don't worry, they're going to crash. But when they crash, are they going to go back and rebuild all those mom and pop bookstores that they knocked out of business? Hell no. That's an efficient society. There are thousands of micro-enterprise lending groups around the world, like the Grameen Bank, small loans to empower people. It's called capitalism. So if you don't have capital, you can't play the game. It's like going to a poker game and you got no money, no chips. Hey, you're not in. So people get like a couple $100 to buy some tools and they become carpenters. Or a woman peasant buys a cow and she sells milk on the street corner, pays back the loan, creates their own bootstraps. And I know, you know, there's some ultra-leftist intellectuals who aren't connected to any of these movements. They go, oh, that's not revolutionary. That's not a threat to capitalism. Hey, dude, neither are you a threat to capitalism, all right? You're writing your little newsletter and sending it out to 2,000 people and you think you're a threat to capitalism. Oh, yeah, I'm sure they're shaking in their boots over your newsletter. You know, and it's this condescending garbage of, see, I have an analysis. Yeah, you know, everybody's got an analysis, okay? Cool it with that stuff. Go talk to peasant women who are illiterate, and they'll explain the world to you, you know? That's how I got educated, was in Africa, these peasant women saying, you got a PhD, you couldn't even run a small farm. You're right, I couldn't run a small farm. And they do run small farms. So the micro-enterprise lending movement is based on the insight of people like Jim Hightower, who say capital is like horse manure. If it's piled, concentrated in one pile, it stinks. If you spread it out evenly, it makes things grow. That's the way it works. That's the way it works. And if you look at, if you take two farms, one is heavily capitalized, very industrialized farm, and the other is a small peasant farm that doesn't have much tools or fertilizer or anything. If you have $100, and you put it into the big one, you're not going to get any percentage increase in output. You put it into that peasant farm, you're going to get like 100%, 200% increase because they never had fertilizer before. They didn't have irrigation water or tools or whatever. So just in terms of math, forget the left-right politics, just in terms of math and what is the right thing to do, the right thing to do is democratize access to capital, not concentrate it. Where's all our capital being concentrated these days? In the banking sector, 40 times as much capital has been sucked into the gambling casino of Wall Street as is in the productive economy making tires and toothpaste and rakes and hoes and whatever else. Community-supported agriculture is taking off like a rocket, where you've got several dozen families, contract a farmer directly, you eliminate the market. This is what I say to these right-wingers. I say, you know what? There's a socialist institution in every community in the United States. They say, what? Socialist institution? Let's get them. What is it? It's called the public library. Right? Because there's no market involved. There's not a money barrier between the person and the service, which is knowledge, books, because even Andrew Carnegie and other millionaires understood the importance of books. Okay, well, what's the public library version of healthcare and housing and energy and transport and all those other important things that we need just as much as books? Don't get me wrong, I love books, but hey, you know. Community-supported agriculture, taking off all over the place. Community currency organizations. If you network a local mom-and-pop bioregional, green, fair trade, renewable economy, you have the basis of a local currency. It's totally legal. You create a local currency, and then you're walking down the street and you got Home Depot on one side and Tony's hardware store on the other side. Tony's a local guy. You see him at the PTA meetings, right? His kid goes to your kid's school. He'll take the local currency because he's going to spend money locally. Home Depot isn't going to take it, right? Because they're repatriating money out of your community back to the Atlanta headquarters and to wherever the shareholders are. This is a colonial model. Look at Africa. The most suffering and exploitation and injustice is in exactly the locations where the most natural wealth was located by nature or God, whichever you prefer. The gold in South Africa produced apartheid. In Nigeria, all the oil, where's the most oil? Niger Delta. Where's the most suffering? Niger Delta. Why? Because it's an extractive model. World Bank, IMF call it export model, but after the EX, just change a few letters, it's an extractive model. Don't even go to the third world. Look at Appalachia, all that coal in the eastern United States. Did it bring welfare and, you know, to the local people? Give me a break. They got a high tattoo-to-tooth ratio among the men. That's a sure sign of poverty right there. You laugh. It's in the literature. Look in the medical emergency room literature, and you will find the tattoo-to-tooth ratio. It means guns and booze were involved, usually. Eco-labeling is also, and I'm not making fun of those people, because I am those people. I come from that culture. I had my first gun. The gun was bigger than me. And guys would go out. We'd go out, kids too. They taught us safety, but there was always booze. Booze and guns. I mean, it's just like, whoa, gunpowder and booze. What a great combination. I always wondered about the sanity of my male relatives. Eco-labeling is taking off, right? Putting labels, the dolphin safe tuna, all that kind of stuff. I think what we need now is, in labeling, we need to go to full content labeling, substantive content labeling, just like with nutrition. We fought for decades to get nutrition labeling. What we need is full biography. What was the social and environmental impact of this commodity? So this lectern, the microphone, this shirt, everything could have a nice little label on it. It's just a design challenge. You know, can you boil down your editing and layout to have it on there? And you got the biography of the commodity, so you can say, oh, wow, this is Oblivion hardwood. The worker gets $1 a day? Oh, God, you know, can you survive on that? Fair trade organizations like Transfair USA, which you should check out their website, transfairusa.org, up in Oakland, which is the U.S. certifier for fair trade coffee and now is branching out into fair trade tea, orange juice, et cetera, like in Europe and other places. We need to demystify all these commodities. All commodities are produced by human beings and nature, and we've forgotten that. The fair trade labeling movement is really taking off. Fair trade coffee, you can now, 3 years ago, and I'm proud of this because I helped participate in the creation of this, when we set up Transfair a few years ago, you go back 3 or 4 years, there was no internationally recognized fair trade labeling in the United States. Now there's over 100 companies that are selling fair trade certified coffee, and it's going up like this. Transfair has over 10 employees, right? So you got millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars that didn't used to go to the 550,000 small farmers that are in the fair trade market in dozens of third world countries. They're now getting millions and millions of dollars that they didn't get before. The fair trade price for coffee is $1.26 a pound minimum floor price. The world market price is below 50 cents, and the farmers actually get about 25 or 30 because they don't own trucks to get it to market. They got to pay whoever owns the trucks whatever they'll get for it, right? So this is a tripling or quadrupling of the income for people whose kids don't have shoes. Is that worthwhile? And it's going to cost you a penny or two more per cup? Huh? Anybody not willing? I want to hear somebody in public be willing to debate. No, I'm not going to pay 2 cents more a cup of coffee. Oh, dude. There's a special place in hell reserved for you. The Tobin tax idea is gaining strength. This is a small tax that would be put on currency transactions internationally. What's the one sector of the economy that has more power than any other? Finance. What's the one sector of the economy that is not taxed? Finance. Duh. All these currency speculation. In two or three days, the currency speculation market turns over as much dollars as all global trade in goods does in a year. This is how out of whack it is, totally out of whack. There's a new trade unionism coming up from the grassroots that is more transnational instead of being nationally focused. It is more community outreach focused, form alliances with NGOs like us. How'd we shut down the WTO in Seattle? It was the trade union movement with about 35,000 people behind us, and then about 10 or 12,000 of the internationalists from all different sectors. Our strength was our weakness. We were fragmented, and we all came together. Fingers are breakable. Fist? Mm-mm. No. And our unity on the outside fostered disunity inside the World Trade Organization meeting. It was the first time ever in late 99 that a World Trade Ministers meeting resulted in nothing. Nothing. They didn't even have a communique. There's alternative communities like Gaviotas in Colombia, Kerala in India, Porto Alegre in Brazil. By the way, if you want to go to Porto Alegre for the Alternative Economy Summit this February, it's first week of February, Global Exchange is organizing a delegation. We already got about 25 people signed up. It's going to be hella good time, as my daughter would say. We're going to Rio for a few days and then to Porto Alegre. There will be tens of thousands of progressive people from every country in the world in Porto Alegre. It's the answer to Davos, the rich guys thing. And it is guys, by the way. A few women, but not many. in Switzerland. The MST, the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, there are all these organizations now that are getting into enterprise. Landless Workers Movement in Brazil has farms that generate $20 to $30 million a year in output per farm. This is serious stuff. We have to develop an alternative accumulation model. You have to create jobs. What are you going to wait for corporations and the corporate state to provide us with meaningful jobs? No. We, the movement, the global justice movement, has to do enterprise. We have to create needed goods and services without exploiting people or exploiting nature and put the profits back into the grassroots, at the base, transnationally. We are the inheritors of 500 years of violent redistribution of wealth on a planetary basis. You go back 500 years to when Columbus came to the Americas, there wasn't a lot of global inequality, right? There was local regional inequality, but a lot of Native Americans had better standard of living than people in Europe with the Black Plague and the Inquisition and the witch burnings and homosexuals being thrown on the fires and all that crazy stuff. It was 500 years of violent redistribution of wealth. We got to undo that in a few decades, but we can do it. We can do it. We know how to do this. So people are raising this question. Who's sitting at the table? Is it monocrop or biodiverse? Is it democratic or not democratic? Minority rule, majority rule? And what are the values? Is it money values, profits for corporations, or is it life values, human rights and the environment? So let's do things like, let's innovate. Let's have global voting, right? Let's have global voting on these big issues. Let's shut down all the militaries, all the national militaries. You got to shut them all down. You can't do it one at a time. Shut them all down at the same time, right? That would be, and I know, you know, people say right away, you know, you have this little naysayer, you know, you have the glasses half empty voice in your head. Oh, you're utopian, Danner. Utopia is a good word, not a bad word. It's like protect, totally positive word. What'd they do? They turned it into protectionism. Protect is a totally positive word. They are polluting the most basic aspect of the human commons, language. We got to take it all back from them, right? So, one of the things that I'm working on for the next 5 or 10 years is what we're calling Global Justice Greenhouse, urban and rural version of it. We get a whole bunch of groups together. We buy a big building. We're working on this in San Francisco and Washington, but it'll work in other places. It would work here. You get a whole bunch of progressive environmental social justice groups, buy a building, and the way you finance it is bonds, nonprofit bonds. We're in a declining yield bond market. Now's the time to issue bonds. And there's going to be revenue generated in the building. You got ground floor retail that's like a fair trade cafe restaurant. There's rooms in the back like this that every night there's activities, educational activities. People come through the restaurant, fair trade cafe, and spend money, right? That's revenue generation. The events in the back are revenue generation. The office rents above are revenue generation. On-site daycare so the workers don't have to be separated from their kids. Rooftop organic garden, solar panels. It becomes a hub of organizing activity, gets a great reputation. You do a united events where you have elder groups and youth groups on the same night, so you get the matchmaking of constituencies, cross-fertilization. Then we do the rural one. The rural one is a big piece of land that's a working organic farm, a CSA farm, that's revenue generation, a retreat center for the urban groups to get out of the city for their strategizing. You can bring in retired leftist professors who have equity in their homes, and they move on to the land, bring their equity with them, and they don't have to go to an HMO warehouse to retire and die. You know, they can be in a community. You get inner city kids out of the city for training. There's weed and seed money, government money that you can get for this. You get the kids out, you do ruckus training camp kind of thing, computer stuff. They go back into the city as little organizers. Yeah, you really stir up some hell. And then we proliferate these urban and rural combined because they're helping each other, right? They're doing revenue generation together and recycling the money down into the community. We get a whole network of these internationally, Johannesburg, Rio, Paris, Lima, San Francisco, Santa Cruz, every place. And we create this international network. We're all wired up, websites, internet, all that kind of stuff together. And we create the Life Economy Network International, Lenny, Life Economy Network International, right? It's all hooked together. We're doing fair trade with each other. When you want to go to South Africa, you go to the Lenny branch down there, the Global Justice Greenhouse that's based there. They got extra rooms. Then they come here. We do the same thing with each other. And then on top of that transnational economic base, we have a Global Citizens Party that is a transnational, the first ever transnational political party. All the existing progressive parties will be part of it. It's a network. It's a coalition of coalitions. And yes, it will run candidates in national elections, but it's not a national party. It is a transnational. It is a Global Citizens Party, right? And we work at defining what does that concept mean, Global Citizens Party. I want to end with this. Mass mobilizing is our most powerful tool. If we can put enough people in the street, educated, analytical people, heads with good analysis, hearts full of love, and belly full of fire, we can change any policy. Plus, you'll never see thousands of corporate business suits out in the street with their attaché cases. There are mass demobilizers, right? That is a tactic that is available to us that is not available to the minority elites. They will never be mass mobilizers. I'll end with this quote from, actually two quotes I want to give you from Martin Luther King, and then I'll shut up. He said, quote, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that." And lastly, he said, he was talking about the civil rights movement, but I think it applies to this global justice movement. He said, "Our political compass is love, and it always points towards solidarity." Thank you very much. I appreciate it.